He who has not been initiated should not pronounce any Vedic text except those required for the performance of funeral rites, since he has an level with a Shudra before his birth from the Veda. Right? In other words, someone who is not up to a particular standard, you know, of initiation shouldn't have the rites of that standard. You know, it's just like until you're married, then you know you don't live with the girl. So when you're married, then you do. So it's just all that kind of a thing. You know, these are the. You know, you have the qualification, then you do it. You don't have the qualification, you don't. So here, it's not the initiation; it's that someone would be qualified to get the initiation, right? So therefore, that's how you understand. So then, someone who has the second initiation, then he performs the rites for that. Prescriptions for students. The student has been initiated must be instructed in the performance of the vows and gradually learn the Veda, observing the prescribed rules. Right? So now, once he's initiated here, then all the very specific things that go along with it, then he does his studies and that. Whatever dress of skin, sacred thread, girdle, staff, and lower garment are prescribed for a student at the time of initiation, the like, again, must be used at the performance of the vows. Right, so in other words, what's the authorized dress? That's what he should be using when he performs his vows. Right? Does that make sense? So whatever you're initiated with, that's what you then use in the performance. Like at initiation, the boy's wearing the dhoti and the chadar. So when he performs artik or abhishek or the, then he wears dhoti and chadar. Does that make sense? That's the prescription. Right, we shouldn't make it up. This is just this is the prescribed rule. Like that. And it's just like you know, I heard the other day someone's wearing, you know, their pants and shirt and everything. And when asked about it, they says, no, Prabhupada just says once you dress like a gentleman. He doesn't say you have to wear a dhoti and a chadar. But that's fine, but try going to a black tie event, which is only for gentlemen, in a pair of pants and a shirt. You won't get in, they'll throw you out. You know, you can't even get into some restaurants dressed like that. You know what I'm saying? And so even amongst the Western gentlemen, they have different things. And if you really get into gentlemen, you know, up to date, what's the right thing at the right time, then, you know, you have your evening dress, your dinner, your this, your that. There's a lot of different things, and I guarantee that that person probably doesn't have any of them. Right, because what he's wearing is what the gentleman would wear when he's not doing anything formal, let alone a religious ceremony. Is that make sense? So this is the problem. So Manu's putting that point, is that what's the qualification, you know, by the Sampradaya, what it considers dress, that's what you wear for the performance of rites. You don't just make it up. You know, if we, like in our line, it's unsewn cloth for doing puja, that's what you wear. You don't come up with all kinds of things. It's Kali Yuga, and, you know, this is modern, and this, we don't care. For all these, don't even bother. Right? Samana's saying is, whatever is the prescribed dress of the Sampradaya, that's what you should be wearing. Right? So topic three, continue. Ordinances of studentship. Right? So the ordinances of studentship we started the dress and everything. But then, now, before you get into the other things, then you have to be able to understand how to respect the elders, you know, the nature of the sacred law, you know, what is the position, why these things are there. So now we continue. 3.6, duties of brahmacharya. But a student who resides with his teacher must observe the following restrictive rules, duly controlling all his organs in order to increase his spiritual merit. Daily worship. Every day, having bathed and been purified, he must worship the deities and place fuel on the sacred fire.
Yeah. Being purified refers to anything specific?
Being, whatever before was rules of, you know, what he has to do. You know, the Achala says before studies, you know, he does Achman, stuff like that. More details would be later, because the full details of purity aren't described with brahmacharis. The basic principles is described with grihasthas, because they have the maximum amount of purity to deal with, the maximum variety, you know. So, generally what you'll see in man is everybody's performing all the various activities. But whoever that activity is more prominent in their ashram, right? So it'd be full. Then the full, complete form is described there. Just like taking care of guests. Now, if a guest comes to the ashram, the brahmacharis would also take care. Sannyasis would take care, vanaprasthas would take care, but they don't have the facility grihasthas do. So the full direction of taking care of guests is described in the grihastha ashram. But it's for everybody. Just like in the sannyasa ashram, all the philosophy will be described. That's for everybody. Okay? But it's just the particular ashram affords that you can do more of that. Right? You know, you have all kinds of facilities. You know, the vanaprastha has a place to sit down on a mat, and that's it. You know, there may be some water out of a pot, but, you know, that's as good as it gets. You know? So, but the grihastha has more facilities. So therefore, what is the complete form will be discussed with them. Then you apply it to your situation. Does this make sense? So, just like here, the respective authority, the respective personalities, the hierarchy, that's all been described in brahmacharya. But they'll probably use it less than the grihasthas will. Right? But because the brahmachari, his whole thing is about respecting the guru, so therefore respect is being given there. But the broadest range of it will always be used by grihasthas. But the principles of it may be described in the grihastha ashram, or it may be described elsewhere. Whoever the principle is the most prominent. Right? So renunciation is most prominent with the vanaprastha sannyasa, so that's where it's described. But grihasthas are also renounced. Restrictions. Let him abstain from meat, perfumes, women, all substances turned sour, and from doing injury to living creatures. Abstention from women indicates abstention from sexual intercourse. In other words, the brahmacharya must practice strict celibacy. The reference to all substances turned acid means those things that are not naturally acidic. Right? Something is not naturally acidic and it's gone acidic, he doesn't get involved.
So does that include things like soy sauce, like things like that?
There would more be what's not so much for consumption. You know, your things are too sour because, see, it's the sourness of it. That's one of the elements. That is bad for brahmacharya. See, if there's a mild sourness, like lemons are sour, you know, that's okay. But when you get into, let's say, tamarind and some other things that get very sour, then that excess sourness thins the semen in the body, right? If semen's thin, then it tends to go down, right? If it's thicker, it stays in place, right? Because the semen's throughout the whole body. If it gets thin, you know, what happens? If you take an ice cube and stick it somewhere, it stays that way. But if it melts, then it goes. So that's the whole point. Does that make sense? So if something's too sour, like that, all these things, too sour, too hot, too pungent, they're all bad for brown. That's why then they don't get overly involved in that. But having become excited by fermentation and other such processes, unless it's something that it's a process used. If the Vedic uses it, like yogurt, milk turns sour, that's okay. You know what I'm saying? So there's some natural things that you use. You take the dough and you let it sit and it gets sour, so then there's certain things that are there, but you have to be very careful, because if it's too far, the chemical content of it is bad for the brahmacharis. Okay, then applying cudgel to his eyes from sensual desire, anger, covetousness. Okay, so abstention from dancing, singing, playing musical instruments means that these activities should not be performed for mundane purposes. Like that. From gambling, idle disputes, backbiting and lying, from looking at and touching women, and from hurting others. For the celibate students who have to speak of embracing or shouldn't be careful not to engage even in this contemplation upon the fair sex. Right, so here then the one was about, when he says women, that means that intimate interaction, and then this means getting too close or just contemplating, like that. So it's giving where the limits are. Let him always sleep alone, let him never waste his manhood, for he who voluntarily wastes his manhood breaks his vow. Okay. Menial service and begging. Let him fetch a pot of water. So now we think of him as a celibate student, right, who lives under the protection of the teacher, under the direction of the teacher. So we've dealt with the teacher. Now we've dealt with, you know, his simple life and all that. Now his services. What does menial service mean? Let him fetch a pot full of water, flowers, cow dung, earth, and kusa grass, as much as may be required by his teacher, and daily go to beg food. Right? So that's the basic work. So all these things, water is always needed, flour for puja, cow dung for doing floors, earth for doing floors, kusa grass, doing puja and things like this. So whatever's required by the teacher for the regular performance of duties, right? Worship and duties, and that's what he arranges.
What's the idea of begging food?
Begging food. Where else will the food come from?
From the market.
And then how do you get it from the market? And then where do you get the money? And where does he get the money? He's in classes all day with the students.
Students' parents?
That will, in this case, maybe take care of his food, but it won't take care of anything personally for the teacher. So the parents don't pay anything that is used by the teacher until after the child graduates. Right? Because otherwise then the parent is hiring the teacher, and then the teacher is under the parent. So Brahmas being independent, they won't function like that. Like here, whatever the parents pay for the students does not take care of teachers. It only takes care of what the students use themselves. Their books, their clothes, their food, maintenance of their facilities, but that's it. It does not pay any facility for the teachers and their food and clothes and everything like that.
So that's the main reason, no? To be independent of the Lord.
No, it's a matter of the dignity of Brahmins. Otherwise, people with money think they own everything. That's the basic principle. You know, people are very rich. You know, they run countries. They own big business. They do it because they have money, and money is required. So therefore, the Brahmins, they just live by begging because they're independent. Now. Also, the begging then makes them humble, like that, because you go. Sometimes they give, sometimes they don't. Yes.
So in the case of the schools here, the teachers want to maintain that ecumenical integrity. So how do they maintain themselves?
People give donations, they have something. People don't, they don't.
So then is it advisable for the parents to give the teachers donations outside of tuition? Is that something that's...
Can, it's no one's ever brought it up, so we've never even thought about it. So you can go down in my 30 years, then you're the first one that's ever brought it up. So, but in that case, that would probably go into the fund that takes care of the teachers. So sometimes people give. We've had people here and there give like that, and so then that goes into there. Problem is not all parents also pay fees, so the teachers also have to figure out the scholarships. So not only have to pay the scholarship, you work out the scholarships, you have to work out the teachers. Like that. Because that's the Brahminical system. Otherwise, if you want to run it as a business, it's you can make big bucks off of this. Like that, you know, we wouldn't be charged. I mean, for what facility we're giving and things like that, if you charge $20,000 a month, no one would blink an eye. There's boarding schools in India that's $60,000 a month. Like that. And I guarantee they don't give food that we give. Like that. You know, they'll have these fancier uniforms that cost more money. Like that. But, you know, stuff like that. But so, you know, it's just what it flat costs us, that's what we charge. And when it costs us more, then we tell you. Like that. You know, that's how it works. So the begging, then it takes care of themselves. So they're at the teacher's house, they go out begging, then there's food for everybody, so then it works. Yeah, does that make sense?
Right.
Yes.
And this way also it makes sure that those who are in the school, they have good standard, because no Vaishya could stand this.
It means that's why no one else runs schools, because the Vaishyas or Kshatriyas, they wouldn't be able to live in that way. They would find some other thing that should be.
It's interesting that they go begging to uphold their dignity.
That's yes.
Nice. From a Western point of view, it's
But it's just you know, it's like it's not well understood, because it's not a problem. It's not discussed much in the Western stories. But like you had that, was it Diogenes, Greek fellow, lived in a barrel. He was considered a great, intellectual or at the time. So Alexander the Great went to visit him. You know, and he went with his generals and all that. And so he came and they were discussing and all this and that, and he's sitting in his barrel. Alexander's there, and at the end, and he says, Alexander, the kingdom, this and that, so whatever you'd like, if, I can do something for you, please let me know. So then Diogenes paused for a moment and says, you could move a little bit out of the way. You're blocking the morning sun. You know? Like that. And so then they walked off. And then as they were walking, they get some distance, cultured distance. Then the generals all start laughing and that. And he says, what a fool. This man, Alexander the Great, just offered him anything, in the world that he wants. And he just asked him to move out of the way, he doesn't understand what this, who Alexander is, this, that, and they're all laughing. Then Alexander stopped and said, if I wasn't Alexander the Great, I'd want to be him. Like that. So he appreciated, he understood. So it's not a well-known, because it's just too eccentric for the most, when it comes to the most, it just doesn't make sense. Like Chanakya. He's a prime, he arranged, he found the king, he trained him, he gave the strategy by which he could be enthroned, he showed him how to consolidate his kingdom, grow the kingdom, and so he's technically the most important person in the kingdom. Like that. But he lives in his grass hut and he goes out begging, takes no money from the king. No facility from the king, because then he's under no obligation. Because otherwise, if you get facility, you're under obligation. That was the problem with Bhishma and Drona. They were taking facility from the king, so they're under obligation. If they had not been doing that, then they could very strongly make their points and, like that.
Why would they do that?
Generally you see these kind of things like Chanakya and that are more rare to see. Because Drona, wanted some the position so he had the facility so he could take care of his son. Because others were insulting his son because they didn't have any facility. Right? He had never had milk ashwatthama. He didn't know what it was. So then the boys were joking, so they took some chalk, mixed it with water, so it was white, and gave him the drink, said it was milk. So he drank that, and he was, yeah, I've had milk and this and that, and they were all laughing. So Androna found out about this, and that's when he went to try to secure his position in the palace. Right. So they're all various considerations within the wide range of, you know, the Brahminical culture. Right? A student, being pure, shall daily bring food from the houses of men who are not deficient in the knowledge of the Veda and in performing sacrifices, and who are famous for following their lawful occupations. In other words, you beg first from those who are considered educated and cultured and, you know, religious. Like that. The means that's the standard. The brahmacharis would beg from them, the grihasthas would beg from them, you know, generally vanaprastha. Sannyasis, it's recommended that do beg, but if not, they can beg elsewhere. Right? Or grihastha, if there's no nice people, then you can beg elsewhere. That'll come up.
Right. For the food. Usually it's recommended that you take food that was cooked by a person with the good, in good standard of consciousness.
Yes.
So if it's not available, then still they would beg cooked food or uncooked food?
It depends what they're getting. Generally, if they're from good houses, then you could take the food, because they'd be Brahmins who are offering it anyway in sacrifice, so you're getting prasad. But if it's for ones who are not, then generally you'd take uncooked food, and then you'd cook that yourself. Let him not beg from the relatives of his teacher, nor from his own or his mother's blood relations. But if there are no houses belonging to strangers, let him go to one of those above named, taking the last named first. Only those with last names you should beg from. You know, if you have a guy whose name is just Sam, you know, like that, then you know, you may have problems. You don't know if he's a serial killer or if he's out of a Dr. Seuss book, you know, like that. So, you know, they have to have a last name, right? How often do you want them to show up at your door? So therefore, then last night, so then could be his mother's blood relations, then from his own, then from relatives of the teacher. Right? So we go that way, because then the relatives from the mother's side would be more inclined, because they always mother's side always gives, the girl's side always gives things to the boy's side, because then the girl is not, how you say, it doesn't appear she's bought. But if it goes from the boy's side to the girl's, then it looks like they're paying something. So generally, traditionally, it always goes the other way, right? And then the relative, the teacher, because of respect for him, he wouldn't take from them. Because if they're going to give something, then they might give it to the teacher himself. Mm-hmm. Or if there are no virtuous men of the kind mentioned above, he may go to each house in the village, being pure and remaining silent. But let him avoid abhishtas, those accused of mortal sin. Right. So then there he won't talk, he won't interact, he'll just go and beg and then go. So everything's very formal. You know, so because of that formality, they'll be in good consciousness, so then, you know, it'll be as good as it gets. But those are mortal sin, killing a Brahmin, stealing the gold of a Brahmin, intoxication, means drunkards and like that, those who sleep with the wife of the Brahmin, and those who associate with those who do those four, then you'll avoid their houses. Because the sin that comes with that is too great, so nobody bothers with that. Right? Even kings, when they take fines and that are connected to these, they put it in a special treasury. It's not used in the regular things. And that, it either gets given to great, very powerful Brahmins and sages, or before his reign ends, you know, before he goes to the forest, he takes all that wealth and it gets thrown into the ocean. you know, so it's offered to Varuna, because Varuna is the lord of the Kshatriyas. Because, you know, the sin is so great, then you don't know how the son will use it. You know, you don't want him to be burdened with that, because he'll collect his own. So, but it's never used for oneself, it's never used for regular stuff. So that's why they're avoided.
Also, Maharaj, mystery for Westerners, how this is possible. It's just mentality, that Western mentality is like...
Yeah, well, that's why then everybody becomes more sinful, because if you use their gold, then you take on those qualities. Because that's the whole thing. Money carries with it the mentality.
Even if you would find it from, let's say, income, treasury or something like
that. Treasure is a different thing. We're talking about fines from mortal sins. We're not talking about a treasure. You find a treasure, then there's some, it'll come up later in the civil law. You know, what happens to treasure? Certain part goes to the government, certain part goes to the personal family. Having brought sacred fuel from a distance, let him place it anywhere but on the ground, and let him, unwearied, make with it burnt oblations into the sacred fire, both evening and morning. Right, so the sacred fuel then should not be just placed on the ground. So all the articles for the yajna don't just go on the ground. They go on something, in something. You know, everything that is respected. He who performs the vow of studentship shall constantly subsist on alms, but not eat the food of one person only. The subsistence of a student on begged food is declared to be equal in merit to fasting. Right? So if he eats the food that's gained by begging, you get the same merit as you get by doing a fast. So that way he's every day fasting. So very astute. Like that, and not of one person, because it's always the same person. So that's why they go and move through the village, and then when you get to the end of the village, you start at the beginning again. Here also is that at his pleasure he may eat when invited the food of one man at a rite in honor of the gods. In other words, when you beg, you're only getting a little bit from everyone. It's called madhu kari. Madhu means bee. Right? The bees, they don't go into one flower and walk off with, you know, a whole sack full of stuff. They get a little bit from each flower. So that's the madhu. So then he's not eating from one person. Right? But it says that he can eat when invited. You know, the food of one person. You mean, in other words, you sit down, you get a full meal from one person. At a rite in honor of the gods. Right? So in other words, some, you know, like that. Observing, however, the conditions of his vow. Right? So in other words, he doesn't eat things that are outside his vow. Or at a funeral meal in honor of the maids. Behaving, however, like a hermit. So that means he's quiet, he doesn't talk, you know, any of these kind of things. This duty is prescribed by the wise for a Brahmin only. No such duties ordained for a Kshatriya or Vaishya. Right? So that means if it's something proper. So we don't eat it, you know, demigod food. So if it's something to do with Krishna and all that, then no problem. We're invited, we go. Like sometimes you get invited for a program, they go to the program, eat, come back. It's just connected with that.
The balance between the begging and the studies worked out by the teacher, right? You'll see.
Well, there's a certain time of the day, because you go out, the time for begging is just before lunch. Because mm-hmm. people cook, then they'll make the offerings and do the Bali dance and all that, then they'll eat. So part of the process is that you've cooked, offered, you've given in charity, then you eat. Right? Because you're first supposed to take care of guests. Mm-hmm. Right? Then, you know, any other, you know, respectable person, right? Because guests will be described later. Then it'll be dependents, you know, so you make sure, you know, whoever else there, the children, you know, how you say, elders, servants, anything like that. Then the grihastha himself eats last. But, slightly different than the Western, how you say, manorical concept. Both when ordered by his teacher, there's an etiquette with the teacher, and without a special command, A student shall always exert himself in studying the Veda and in doing what is serviceable to the teacher. So studying and doing service, you know, that's that you prove service, that then he can always be engaged in. When the teacher tells him, he's engaged. Even when the teacher doesn't tell him, if he does those two, it's proper. Right? Otherwise, then things should be asked. Controlling his body, his speech, his organs of sense, and his mind, let him stand with joined hands, looking at the face of his teacher. Right? So it's not that he's, you know, if you're talking or this or that, he's looking down or looking away or checking out something else. He has to be looking at the teacher, because then the interaction works. Let him always keep his right arm uncovered, behave decently, and keep his body well covered. And when he is addressed with the words, "Be seated," he shall sit down facing his teacher. Right? So the right arm is always uncovered. So if when one's studying, you know, in front of the teacher, when one's in front of cows, or one's in front of Brahmins, or one's in front of the deities, the right arm is always supposed to be uncovered. Right? But it says also well covered. Right? So he's properly covered. You know, they wear, you know, what's appropriate, you know, what kids can wear. So that much, you know. So they might, you know, it might be short or this or that, but he's covered properly. Right?
When the arm is uncovered?
Because all worship is done with the right arm. So if there's something there, it gets in the way. It's also the element of humility. Like that. So the neck, the arm is uncovered. You do achman. Because otherwise you put on so much stuff, just that you can't do anything with it. You know, it doesn't work. You know, then it also means that then you're appropriately dressed. You know, you understand the culture. You're willing to take part in that. You know, so there's an element of even just the aspect of acceptance of that. That you're a brahmachari, so you follow that directive. Because otherwise then, you know, there's always a thing, you want to be unique, then the brahmachari wants to be unique, he won't cover his arm. He'll always wear the chadar the other way, because then that he stands out from everybody else. Like that. So you then have to explain, you know, what it's for. But otherwise, they're not so inclined, because then they're like, because if everybody else wore it the other way, he'd have his arm uncovered. So it's all about uniqueness, not about following the rules. So you have to learn to be able to follow rules. Like that.
Well, I've seen that for sannyasi sometimes the dhoti goes the other way.
But the thing is it's only a knot, so the arm is still out. In the presence of his teacher, let him always eat less, wear a less valuable dress and ornaments than the former, and let him rise earlier from his bed and go to rest later. Briti, in the presence of his teacher, the student should eat less than teacher, unless encouraged otherwise by the teacher. Right? In other words, he's not going to just on his own get really enthusiastic, completely forget this situation. The student should rise earlier and take rest later, so he may always be ready to render service. Because if teacher's gone to bed, then there's no more service, so he goes to sleep. And then he gets up because there might be service to do when the teacher wakes up. You know, that's the... Let him not answer or converse with his teacher reclining on a bed, nor sitting, nor eating, nor standing, nor with an averted face. Right? So one has to be...
standing?
Yeah, so another, he can't sit, he can't stand, he can't lay down.
So floating in the air.
You're getting there. You don't do that?
I'll be better prepared tomorrow.
Okay, now it explains that. Let him do that standing up if his teacher is seated. Right?
Yeah.
Okay. Advancing towards when he stands, going to meet him if he advances, and running after him when he runs. Right? In other words, the teacher walks in, he's standing up, you're sitting down, you don't stay sitting down, you stand up. Right? Or if he's sitting down, you don't stand there, you kneel down, or, you know, in other words, you have to adjust to the situation that the teacher's in. Like that.
So when you're floating in the air, I'll be floating in the air.
Yeah, like that. Okay, Does that make sense? So you make an adjustment. So it'll be cultured. Then if he's standing, then you'll go towards him, right? If he's moving towards you, then you'll be quicker about it. Or if he's going, and then you follow. So like that. Going around to face the teacher if his face is averted, right? So if the teacher's looking the other way, you want to talk to him, you don't call out, you go around in front where you can see. Approaching him if he stands at a distance, but bending towards him if he lies on a bed, and if he stands at a lower place. In other words, it says you would be standing if he's sitting, unless he asks you to sit, but you would be not, so you would be some way making some kind of adjustment. When his teacher is near, let his bed or seat be low. Within the sight of his teacher, you shall not sit carelessly at ease. Right? So in other words, you do those kind of things when you're on your own, not when the teacher's around. Let him not pronounce the mere name of his teacher without adding an honorific title, behind his back even, and let him not mimic his gait, speech, and deportment. Right? So you never say the name of the teacher without some aspect of respect. You know, that would always be something that would be added. You know, even if he's not around, he's just talking amongst the other students or like that. You won't do that. Okay, not mimic his gait, speech, or deportment. You know, so you don't make fun of him. Like that. That could be that one aspect, or that you mimic that, and therefore you think you're like him. You know. Wherever people justly censure or falsely defame his teacher, he must cover his ears or depart thence to another place. Even if it's justly, it doesn't matter. It's not his business. By censuring his teacher, though justly, he will become in his next birth an ass. Right? By falsely defaming him, a dog, he who lives on his teacher's subsistence will become a worm. And he who is envious of his merit, a larger insect. You know, sometimes these very big insects. So they're the ones who are envious of the teacher. You've got big, right? And donkeys, and you know, and then nobody likes their talking. You know, because he censured his teacher, even though you know, maybe justly, but he becomes a donkey, right? Does that make sense? And because the donkey is not actually good association, that's why then the law is don't steal your neighbor's donkey. Right?
Yes.
Otherwise you're just increasing your bad association.
Makes sense. Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Okay. Lives on his teacher's subsistence, right? So that's why the brahmachari also goes begging. So he's not living off the teacher. Like that. These prohibitions towards censuring or defaming include that such comments should not even be heard by the student, as mentioned in verse 200. So basically, he doesn't do these things, and he avoids anybody who does. Like that. He must not serve the teacher by the intervention of another, while he himself stands aloof. Right? Means, you know, sweeping the floor. Someone else is, let's say it's after Prashad, so they're cleaning. Someone else went to start cleaning, so you just sit around and watch. No, if you can, you take part. Whatever's going on, you're there part of. If you're already doing a service, you don't have to worry about the other services. But if you're doing none, and other brahmacharis are doing something, you don't just sit and watch. Right? You do something. Nor when he himself is angry, because then he's not going to do it properly. Nor when a woman is near. Okay, so you won't do any service around the teacher when the teacher's with his wife, you know, or interacting with his women. You know, you'll do something else, and then when they're not there, then you come back and do that. That makes sense. Because otherwise they can't interact properly.
Business and pleasure separate or something like that?
No, it means that means the teacher is teaching you, that's as a Brahmin, it's an occupation, but he also has his own life.
Yeah.
Right? And as a Brahmin, it may be very simple, so there's not a lot of facilities. So it's not like, he hangs out with his wife in the West Wing, and he teaches the boys in the East Wing, like that, and the parties are in Central Maine, like that. No, it doesn't have that facility. Therefore, if the teacher's interacting with the women of the house, then he goes and does something else, because otherwise, where are they going to get their privacy? Where are they going to get that time? Right. Otherwise, she's going to get upset and then want some other facility. Then he is going to have to go get a job, so he won't be able to teach. So, therefore, if she gets her time by everybody being conscious, then... If he is seated in the carriage or on a raised seat, he must descend and afterwards salute his teacher. Right. So if he's on some kind of thing, he must come down and offer his respects.
They ever do that on a bicycle if
they pass the Maharaj? Some do, a lot do. Yeah. At least with me. I don't know about other Maharajas, but with me a lot do. Actually, they're on scooters now. I know, some of the Indians do. Like that. They'll be riding their motorcycle to stop, get off. Like that. But I only know one who does that. Yeah, but bicycle is quite common.
Have that bicycle stand down.
It doesn't matter. Even if you put the bicycle stand down, the bicycle always falls over. I don't know why. As long as I've been watching, they offer the basin and says, stand there while they're standing. As soon as they bow down, then it'll fall over. Always. I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure why. But it occasionally they'll go to put it, and then just they start, it falls over, so then they got to be like that.
It's because the student shouldn't feel like a fool in front of the teacher.
Could be.
He kicks the bike.
Yeah, that's it. Or it could be the bike's is going to fall. Let him not sit with his teacher to the leeward or to the windward of him, nor let him say anything which his teacher cannot hear. The prohibition about the leeward or windward sides is given because a person sitting on the leeward side, downwind, cannot be properly heard by the other. Right? So it means if you're leeward or windward, one of you can't hear. Right? Like that. So that's the whole point. And then that is, you may be speaking properly, but because of the wind they can't hear. And then the other point is that don't mumble. Right? Not that many teachers speak mumble like that. Though you might think that, in their process of education, that somehow or another it's not on most school curriculums. So most don't know mumble. Right. Or in other words, if the teacher's also around, he doesn't sit around and whisper with his friends. He speaks so that they can hear. Unless... you're just speaking quietly, but you don't on purpose speak quietly so that he doesn't hear what you're saying, because you don't want him to hear that, because you get in trouble. He may sit with his teacher in a carriage drawn. Now, these are where you can sit on an equal level. He may sit with his teacher in a carriage drawn by oxen, horses, or camels, on a terrace, on a bed of grass or leaves, on a mat, on a rock, on a wooden bench, or in a boat. Because you don't really have any other alternatives, so these work. Right. So a Ferrari would work, because that's a horse, right?
Yeah.
Lamborghini. I think Peugeot also. No, they use a drag. They use a drag.
Lamborghini would be an oxen.
A Mini would be an oxen. Okay.
No, a Lamborghini.
A Lamborghini would be an oxen.
Carriage drawn by an oxen.
Okay, so then oxen. So there you got two of them. Now camel. I'm not sure what would be that. Really, I always thought that was like squirrels or something.
They're all measured in horsepower.
Oh, yeah, they're all measured in horsepower. Good point. Okay, so then now we've increased it to all motorized vehicles. Good point. If his teacher's teacher is near, let him behave towards him as towards his own teacher. But let him, unless he has received permission from his teacher, not salute venerable persons of his own family. Ooh, this is one we've gotten in so much trouble for. I've had parents threaten to take their kids out of school Because when the kids are with the teacher, they don't stop, leave the teacher, go over, respect their parent, and then hang out with them however they want, and then come back when the parent gives the permission. Then they say, you know, what's the respect, this and that, and that. No, but the law is that because the teacher is more respected than the father, so therefore that's the way it works. Like that. So we've had a problem with this. So if the teacher's near, then you deal as the teacher, right? I think, I'm not sure if it'll mention here or later, it mentions if you're doing worship, that the worship for the teacher's teacher is double that of the teacher. So whatever facilities you arrange for the teacher should be double that for the teacher's teacher.
So for us, if we think...
So in other words, it means for us, we would, you know, whatever you make for your own spiritual master, you should do double that for Prabhupada. You know, so if your Vyasa Puja is as big as this room, then you make one for Prabhupada that's twice that big. In other words, you just basically put up a little pandal on the edge of the temple. So you walk into the temple, that's the arrangement for Prabhupada, like that. Okay, so, but, you know, if it's there, if they're not doing, then the teacher gives permission. You know, if it's suitable, but it's not that it's necessary. This is likewise ordained as his constant behavior towards other instructors in science, towards his relatives to whom honor is due, towards all who may restrain him from sin or may give him salutary advice. Right? So he must behave properly with anybody who's respectable. Right? Because the brahmachari is the most junior in the social status. So everyone here. So these are persons who you would consider, right? In other words, the teacher, then those who instruct him in the various branches, like the upadhyayas, like we were saying, towards his relatives who honor is due, right? If they're junior to you, then it's not, but if they're senior, towards who all may restrain him from sin, you know, who will give good advice and everything like that, or who, you know, that, you know, is that he wants, they do so, they stop him, you know, out of well, you know, this. So these persons like that. Towards his betters, let him always behave as towards his teacher. Right? In other words, that's the basic. In other words, if the basis here you see is how you behave with the teacher, with the guru, right? So if you lower the standard, because this is human nature, if you lower the standard of the meaning of guru or his worship, what does that effectively do?
Reduces
the respect for everybody. This is a modern concept. You can reduce for the guru and keep it for everybody else, or reduce for the guru and make everybody else go up, right? Because there's only so much respect available. So if the guru gets it, no one else gets it. So therefore, if you don't let the guru have it, then there'll be plenty for everybody else. No, if you do that, nobody gets any respect. Right? Like I was saying, when we were brahmacharis in the 70s, someone who was second initiated, right, we dealt with probably as good, if not better, than what we would call senior men now, who you would respect. You know, the temple president, we dealt with them like nowadays the sannyasis on a good day, because sometimes people don't even care. But when you actually did something like that, sannyasis, we would deal like nowadays some people deal with Prabhupada. And Prabhupada, it's, you don't even see it. So it's just the level of respect was so much greater because the concept of respect of guru was great. Therefore, respect of everybody else was also great. But you reduce it for guru, then you reduce it for everybody else. It's just the way it works. It's not that you can go around it. These are the laws of Manu. It means these are laws already in place. Manu is just there to ensure that they happen. It's not that, well, this is what they do in the Vedic culture. No, it's just like, it's just like you have gravity. It's a Vedic law, right? It's God's law. And it's in the Shastra. Right? Ananta is gravity. So it's not that because you are a different religion, therefore gravity doesn't affect you. It's not like that. Towards his betters, let him always behave as towards his teacher. Likewise, towards the sons of his teacher, born by wives of equal caste. And towards the teacher's relatives, both on the side of the father and of the mother. In other words, the teacher and anyone connected with him, then you should deal respectfully.
We had a different situation. The sons of Prabhupada, it was offered respect.
No, but means you're respectful, but it's not that you don't give any facility. It says respect, not facility. So you deal nicely. But the point is here you're dealing on, if he was in the family, then that would have more meaning. But if he's not in the family, it's not quite the same. You know what I'm saying? Still, you're respectful in your dealings, but it's not that there's there's not a connection at this point. You know what I'm saying? Because now it's the spiritual family, so therefore, then it would be more like his godbrothers and stuff like that. You know? Then you'd be more careful.
Student and teacher relationship. I understand that the respect should be there, but is it also can be some relationship more, you know, like just maybe friendship or these other things come up?
If you create an awareness of the, or one becomes aware of someone's good qualities. Right? Then there's appreciation. Right? So that's Shanta Ras. When that deepens, there's an interest to render service. It becomes Dasya Ras. Right? When that deepens, then there's friendship. When that deepens, they're parental. So it teaches parental Ras, so that means it already includes the other three. But because of the formality, therefore there's more of a chance that the child will listen to the teacher than they will to the parent. Right? Because the point is if you walk into the room, does that change necessarily how your children sit or act or behave? No, but when the teacher walks in, it changes. Because there's no bodily connection. So there's what can you use? You can't use attachment as the symptom of possession. You know what I'm saying? Because the element of possession is what then clouds things. So here there's no possession. So therefore, instruction is given, there's nothing to cloud it. Does that make sense? That's why there must be mother, father, and teacher. Right? Because the other two then give you that proper support and all that, so that human element is there. But then the guidance then comes from the teacher. Because parents can give guidance up to a particular age, but after that they can't. But then, if when you can't give any more, you turn them over to someone else, it's already a bit late. You know what I'm saying? You know, that's not the point. So, just like, let's say a river is there, you know it's going to flood. So, when do you start putting the sandbags? When it's already flooded, or well before it floods? Right, so therefore, that's why the student comes at an early age, before the flood. So you have a relationship. The difference is that the gurukul means you're living in the place of the teacher, so the environment is informal, but the relationship is formal. But at the home, both are informal. So there's the learning is not there. The kids learn from the parents, but not necessarily by the instruction. It's by the example. So basically, by the time the kid's five, whatever you do has already been, you know, imprinted on their mentality. And so then you see it when they get big. So when they have kids, they'll do whatever you did. Like that. That's how it works. So that's the main time, from conception up to five. That's the time when they absorb all these, in other words, all the foundational elements. Then the teacher makes them aware of that, because the parent can't necessarily. Because if you think back about it, okay, you know, what instruction that, you know, one of your parents or one of your family members gave you that really stuck with you, you know, really, you know, how you say, had some bearing in life, or you really worked on it. You know, if someone has one,
it's just followed the instructions.
No, not that. I mean, it's just like now. Let's say if I say, what would you say was the most valuable thing that your parents taught you, or something like that? And then you can, you know, you'd have to think about it. And then you go back, well, once my father said this, or my grandfather said this, or my grandmother said this. But it's one thing. So, good. You know, but that will come anyway in the time spent here or there. But the point is there's a lot more to become aware of. So that's the teacher then can teach so much. Does that make sense? You know, it's just like if you had, you know, one of these authors, you know, write a book about their times with their parents. I don't think you'd get as much volume in that as they did as their time with Prabhupada. Yes?
Most of us don't remember consciously the experiences that we had from five back down, but we have more memories of six and seven and on up in terms of the example that our parents have set and interactions that we've had with them. So how is it that from zero to five those impressions are deeply made in terms of the behavior and the role modeling and we can't consciously remember that was?
Because the thing is what you do is what's in long-term memory, not in the short-term, not in the immediate. You know, it's just like let's say, like a potato is a potato, and even if you put it in a subject with a cauliflower, you know, a thin amount of the outside will take on a cauliflower-ish kind of flavor. But inside is the potato. Does that make sense? So the point is that, as we said, it says that the first birth is animal birth. So animals are very good at picking up on moods and vibes and all that, not necessarily, you know, more distinct logical points. So how the parents interact, they don't know, but when they grow up, then they act just like their parents. So how the father dealt with the mother is how the son will deal with his wife. Like that. So those impressions are there. The other thing is that you're conscious of that there, but then unless there's training, what you'll do with it. So the point is that you're conscious of those, but is someone teaching you what to do with those? That's the point. But the teacher does. The parents won't. See, it's like this. If I own something, it's mine. So it does what I want when I want it to. Right? Because possession means when I feel like it, I use it. When I don't feel like it, I don't. Right? So if I feel like giving some instruction, I do. If I don't, I don't. Right? So, you know, been, you know, at work all day and it's been a tough day and you come home and then you read the paper, maybe watch a little television or, you know, eat something or, you know, where's the time? You know, you understand? You know, the mother's been doing this and that all day and picking up the socks and some of the men love to leave around the house and all these different things like that and this lady said this and that lady said that and where's the time? Because it's yours, so the point is because it's yours, it's going to do whatever you want. So therefore, if you like it like this, the child automatically likes it like that. You know, or if the parent... the parent doesn't feel that there's something to teach to the child as far as lifestyle because they're already part of their scene. So it's automatic that whatever the parent's thinking and feeling, they think the child already is like that. That's the oneness. But the point is the child doesn't think like that at all. That's why they have to be trained. Then they'll think like that. So the parents will give certain things, let's say, in the lifestyle. Like you learn the lifestyle from your parents. Like you can use toilet paper because they did. You know, you can, you know, how you say, use a hair blower because they did. You know, you can put on makeup and stand there for 45 minutes because they did. You know what I'm saying? You can go into the closet that's, you know, from that side to over there and look at it and say, I have nothing to wear because they did. Does that make sense? So these are all the things that you've learned from them by their example. But what is the standard, what you should do with this that they don't do? They may themselves be working on things, but they don't share that with the child. They just take it as automatically, I'm feeling this. I have affection for the child, so the child automatically thinks the way I think. Does that make sense? So that's, so as far as learning those aspects of the life, that the parents do perfectly. But why you should live that way, why you should do things, what is human life, that they generally don't teach. You know, so whatever the standards are is, you know, okay, we don't wear, you know, we make sure our shoes are clean before you come in the house and all stuff. You know, whatever it is the standard may be higher, or we don't just put things down, you put it back in its place. But that's just because that's the way the parent lives, not that that's the law. Right? So now let's say that is the law. So it's the teacher that teaches you why it should be done. For the parent, it's just you do that because that's the way we live. Does that make sense? So in other words, the species of life that the parent is, they will by association make their children into that same species. That they'll do. But what that species duty is, how it's supposed to connect to the Lord and that's not necessarily what they teach. You know what I'm saying? As I said, is this clear? Do we need to go any farther, or because I'm afraid to go farther because I don't want to, how you say, step on any landmines.
I was going to say step on toes, but yours is good.
Does that make sense? Like that. In other words, there's a reason for all these things, and each thing has its position that it's ideal for. So parents add something that the teacher's not going to add. But at the same time, there's something the teacher will add that the parents cannot add. And if we accept that, it works very nice. But if the parent has to be, I only feel comfortable as a fair parent if I'm the only one that the child is dependent upon, who they love, who they consider that they're, you know, doing anything for or anything like that. Otherwise, it gets in the way. You know, it's just like Guru Myers comes to town for 2 weeks and the child's off doing all kinds of things for them. But, you know, then the mother's thinking, well, they never do that for me. You know what I'm saying? And so you can either have, you know, emotional breakdowns there, or next time the mother will arrange that they're somewhere else or doing other important things so that the child can't do that. And this means most of the time they make up absurd examples just to get the point across. This is dead fact. You know, like that. Same goes. You know, the guru's in town, the wife is off, hey, he doesn't do that for me, and I'm just a husband, and you're supposed to, you know, like this and that, you know, or the other way around. It's just like this. This is reality. So that's why there's what is done by parents and what is done by the teacher. So that way then nobody feels bad. You know, if the child has more emotional affection for the parent than the teacher can't get upset. But if the child follows the parent more, I mean the teacher more than the parent get upset. You know? We've lost lots of students because the student would listen to the teacher more than the parent, and the parent could not emotionally handle that. They just couldn't handle it. They pulled their kids out of the school. So this is, yes.
Well, two things. One is that you know, when the child matures into an adult, they're going to figure out how to use what they got from the teacher and what they got from
right.
the adult. And it's not going to be so, seem like such an isolated thing, like
right.
following the teacher, following the parent.
No, it's not. Because
them against each other.
It's just like, it's the same thing as that I'm only saying this because I'm dealing teacher to parent. There's no kids involved in this. If there were kids involved, I wouldn't use these examples. Right? Does that make sense? Because I left this out. I stopped myself. Front row here can attest to that. Because the same example is, because of that attachment, when the parents go to divorce, each parent thinks the kid's going to go with them and completely be on their side against the other parent. But the kids aren't like that. They just said, this is stupid. This is my mother. This is my father. They're going to be like that the rest of my life. Right, and then here's my teacher. So for them, it's all one package. The adults see it as compartmentalized.
And then the other thing is that would fit nicely in the axiom or the paradigm that it takes a whole village to raise
yes.
a child.
Yes. That's why I mentioned here also, to the teacher, then, instructors, like that, relatives whom honor is due, all those who may restrain him from sin, because there's always someone in the locale that comes up and gives you some good advice, or, you know, tells you, you know, they're there watching, but you don't notice them because they're just a nobody. But they come up and tell you this is not good, you know, or somebody just gives you some good advice. So that's the inclusion of the village. Does that make sense? So that's the whole idea of this, is that these things are already included. The Vedic includes these things, but what they put where, the whole village is included because of the element of respect, not of sentiment. Because the point is the whole village can have sentiment, but if you don't have respect, you won't follow it. So the only reason that you will be able to be raised by a village is if you respect that village. That doesn't come out. You know, just like everyone has rights, no one talks about anybody's obligations. It just doesn't happen. You have the Bill of Rights, where is the obligation? So this is your right, so therefore here's your obligation. This is your right, here's your obligation. It doesn't, Magna Carta, this, they don't mention that. So it's all that has this problem of being overbalanced. So we're sorry if sometimes we overbalance the other way in making the point. You know,
like Bill of Obligations.
Yes. That's, yeah. Is that okay now?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. Yeah.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Jai Śrīla Prabhupāda ki,
Jai
Samavita Bhaktivinoda ki,
Jai
Janatāi Gaura Krishna.
Hare Krishna.